Skipping down, once a version of an historical event has been published, it tends to become fixed in the minds of the reading public, especially since nearly all of the subsequent treatments of the subject copy in toto that which has gone before them. Original research is time-consuming, and it is easier for an author to comb the works on his particular subject which are already in print and synthesize their contents, rather than spend weeks and months in dusty archives. It is unfortunately true that the reading public will accept nearly anything they see in print, no matter how irrational or deceptive it might be. Even if a government which has instructed its literary defenders to prepare its brief for history topples from power, the defenders themselves carry on the defense of their theories because the entity which they represented, for love or money, is not as important as their professional reputation and the ability to market further extensions of their interpretations of history. I would add here that the debate surrounding the assassination of President Kennedy is a very good example of how the kinds of pressures being described here by Gregory Douglas are brought to bear. I would note that even a congressional committee, the House Select Committee on Assassinations itself, badly compromised, concluded that there was a 95% probability of a conspiracy behind President Kennedy's assassination, and among the recommendations they made to the U.S. Department of Justice was that they begin an investigation of David Ferry and the anti-Castro Cubans in New Orleans. That was who former New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison was after in his investigation, and yet the notion that there was a conspiracy behind Kennedy's assassination and Garrison's investigation in particular have been roundly attacked in the last couple of years in the wake of the Oliver Stone film JFK about Jim Garrison's investigation, despite the fact that much of Garrison's investigation has been borne out by subsequent events. Garrison died a discredited individual, and indeed Oliver Stone has been subjected to the same firestorm of criticism for basically accurately portraying the historical record. Many of the events that occurred in and around World War II have been subject to similar pressures, and indeed the forces pressuring the contemporary American journalistic community to stick with the established history, i.e. the Warren Report, are the same forces that have applied pressure to distort the history of the Third Reich, including that episode of the Third Reich that we're looking at this evening, the death, the quote death, unquote, of Adolf Hitler. Continuing with Gregory Douglas's analysis. To the list of subjects vulnerable to successful revisionism must be added the fate of Adolf Hitler. No historical personage since the Emperor Napoleon has created so much personal adulation or loathing. For years after his departure from the stage of history, Napoleon was publicly condemned for the damage his detractors said he did to the social, political, and economic fabric of all of Europe. He was, however, secretly admired by most of his surviving soldiers and others, although in France, public admiration was strictly forbidden and punishable by the lackluster Bourbon kings who replaced him. Over 100 years elapsed before any degree of historical objectivity emerged, and there are still hot spots of controversy smoldering in the old ruins. Had Napoleon managed to escape to the United States after the final fall of his empire as he planned, the fury of his enemies would have been monumental, and endless demands for his extradition would have been made upon the American government. Napoleon, at least, came into the captivity of the British and remained in their custody until his death on St. Helena. His fate was clear and well known, and aside from continuing arguments about the causes of his death, there is no question at all about his final days. Hitler's end, on the other hand, is filled with mystery, unresolved questions, and deliberate obfuscation. Much of this is due to a simple lack of provable fact, coupled with an intense desire to write an official end to his life and career. If Hitler had committed suicide in his bunker, he might have escaped a devoutly desired revenge, but at least he was dead, and hopefully would soon be forgotten. As the Soviet army was the first to occupy the Chancellery complex where the suicide was later reported to have taken place, their reports were the first to be issued. There was great confusion, and conflicting reports of bodies found or not found were released to the world press by different spokesmen of the communist political and military commands. In October of 1945, just before the commencement of the Nuremberg trials, British intelligence released a report commissioned by its chief and prepared over a four-month period by Hugh Trevor Roper, a specialist in medieval literature and a British intelligence officer. This report, which was both timely and literate, gained immediate acceptance and has served as the basis for all subsequent accounts of the final days in the Chancellery. All mainstream writers, without fail, use the Trevor Roper Report as the basis for their writings, and the subject and the tales told by the British scholar in 1945 have become, for want of serious challenge, the accepted version. We're going to see later on in tonight's discussion just how flimsy that accepted version is, but it is. The death of the Last Days of Hitler by Sir Hugh Trevor Roper is viewed as the state-of-the-art work about Hitler's, quote, demise, unquote. Skipping down in the article. Although Hitler's death in Berlin had become publicly accepted, both the American and Soviet governments were not satisfied with the official version, and as late as 1953 were still conducting investigations. Indeed, the difference between academic and journalistic reality as portrayed by Sir Hugh Trevor Roper and hardcore political reality as portrayed by the ongoing investigations by American and Soviet intelligence here, this serves to contrast the difference in what we perceive to be real and what is real. As I would note here, there were also elements within U.S. intelligence which were apparently hiding information from other elements who were not sufficiently highly classified to have access to it. Because as we shall see, just what did happen to Adolf Hitler was, at least up to a point, known by U.S. intelligence. Because his benefactor, the person who helped him escape, Heinrich Müller, the head of the Gestapo, went to work for U.S. intelligence after World War II. Continuing here with Gregory Douglas's analysis. Colonel Boris Pash, P-A-S-H, one of the most interesting and effective American intelligence operatives, had an office under his control in the 1950s, which was continuing to probe into the final weeks in Berlin and Hitler's ultimate fate. Pash was by no means a lightweight bureaucrat. Born of a Russian father, Pash had been in Russia just after the revolution and was fluent in Russian. A reserve officer in military intelligence, Pash was activated at the beginning of the war and was initially involved in the relocation of Japanese-American citizens and later became the chief counterintelligence officer for the Manhattan Project. During the war, Pash was in charge of Operation Alsos, A-L-S-O-S, which entailed the location and removal of top-level German atomic and chemical warfare experts to American service. Following the war, Pash was Army coordinator with the CIA's Bloodstone operation. This was the name of the project which recruited German and other nationalities for use by the CIA in clandestine operations against the Soviets. In 1949, Pash joined the CIA as an administrator in their Office for Policy Coordination, where he was in charge of a group dealing with assassinations and kidnapping. At the same time that Pash was employed in locating and utilizing former Nazis in the service of the CIA, Soviet intelligence and the U.S. Army's CIC were also actively engaged in trying to trace the supposedly dead Führer in such places as Spain and Latin America. Indeed, as we shall see, the official versions of what happened to Adolf Hitler as presented by the West in the form of Sir Hugh Trevor Roper and by the Soviet Union in the form of work put out in 1968 by Lev Bezymensky, well, they are highly questionable, to say the least. And I'm being very, very charitable when I call them highly questionable, as we shall see in our examination of the official histories. These official histories are badly, badly flawed and certainly cannot be taken as factual. In fact, much of them appear to be deliberate disinformation in order to lay to rest a very troubling question. Suffice it to note here that as late as 1953, both U.S. and Soviet intelligence continued to have personnel and resources committed to finding out just what had happened to Adolf Hitler. What we're going to look at now is what didn't happen to Adolf Hitler. By the way, once again, research credit on all of these articles from the military advisor to a listener. This is from the Military Advisor's issue of Fall of 1990, Volume 1, Number 4, again subheaded the publication for international military hobbyists and historians. This particular article is called Smoke and Mirrors. It's also authored by Gregory Douglas, the author of the article that we just read part of. And this particular account deals with the disappearance, among other things, of the dental records from most of the top officials of the Third Reich. They disappeared. They have never been found. This is significant because there have been two alleged identifications of Adolf Hitler as a suicide in the courtyard of the Führer bunker, both of these based on comparisons between either partial head x-rays and or drawings from memory by Hitler's dentist. And I would note that the original records, the original dental records for Hitler, vanished, calling into serious question the veracity of the alleged identifications, the one made by the Soviet KGB officer, Mr. Lev Bezymansky, or at least the one that had his nom de plume on it, the other by a dentist at the University of California named Dr. Ridar Sognes. We're going to take a look at these two alleged dental identifications and the serious problems with using dental records to identify Adolf Hitler. Again, his dental records vanished. Again, this article is entitled Smoke and Mirrors by Gregory Douglas, and it begins, when Soviet troops occupied the government sector of Berlin during the first week of May of 1945, an immediate search was made of the Chancellery complex for any traces of Hitler and his top aides. Much of Speer's new chancellery was in ruins. That's Albert Speer of the Third Reich. Much of Speer's new chancellery was in ruins. The air raid bunker under the chancellery garden was partially flooded by the ever-present groundwater, and the interior showed signs of an attempt to burn the contents by the last SS guard units on the scene. There were numerous bodies strewn about the chancellery grounds, including those of Dr. Goebbels and his wife, both of whom were badly charred. The bodies of General Hans Krebs, K-R-E-B-S, and the six Goebbels children were found in the bunker. There was no trace whatsoever of Hitler, his wife, and other close members of his entourage. Since the Russians had complete physical control of the chancellery area, and if Hitler's body had been discovered, they would have been the sole parties to disclose this. Let us consider the official Soviet pronouncements following their capture of Berlin. Now, the next presentation here, the next series of items presented by Gregory Douglas is very important, because let's take a look at the official pronunciations by the Soviets about Hitler's fate in the weeks following the fall of Berlin and the conclusion of hostilities in Europe. May 3rd, continuing with Gregory Douglas's account, May 3rd, 1945, Pravda, Hitler, quote, Hitler not in Berlin, unquote. May 13th, 1945, Pravda, quote, Moscow had directed the senior officers of the Red Army in Berlin to discuss nothing about the situation in the Führer bunker, unquote. May 26, 1945, Joseph Stalin to Harry Hopkins in Moscow, quote, in my opinion, Hitler is not dead, but is hiding somewhere, unquote. June 6, 1945, Red Army spokesman from Marshal Zhukov's staff, quote, Hitler's body has been found and identified, unquote. That from June 6th. Now, 3 days later, a different story. June 9, 1945, Marshal Zhukov, accompanied by Andrei Vyshinsky, Deputy Foreign Minister, and General N. Bezarin, B-E-Z-A-R-I-N, Soviet Military Commandant of Berlin, held a press conference for Western journalists. Zhukov stated that, quote, Hitler's fate was doubtful, unquote, and that, again quoting, we did not identify the body of Hitler. I can say nothing definite about his fate. He could have flown away from Berlin at the very last moments, unquote. As we shall see, there are numerous indications that, in fact, that was the case. Continuing, General Bezarin added that in his personal opinion, quote, he has disappeared somewhere in Europe. Perhaps he is in Spain with Franco. He had the possibility of taking off and getting away, unquote. As we shall see, that is almost certainly what happened. Same day, June 9, 1945, Red Star military publication stated that, quote, Hitler had committed suicide 2 days before Berlin surrendered, unquote. So obviously we're being presented with contradictory accounts from various Soviet sources here. July 17, 1945, Joseph Stalin to President Harry Truman and U.S. Secretary of State James Burns at the Potsdam Conference, quote, I believe Hitler is alive. Careful research by Soviet investigators has not found any trace of Hitler's remains or any other positive evidence of his death, unquote. Following these often contradictory pronouncements, the Soviets lapsed into silence until 1968, when a small book entitled The Death of Adolf Hitler appeared, authored by Lev Bezymensky, a Soviet journalist and KGB official. According to the thesis of this book, the Soviets did in fact find the bodies of Adolf Hitler, that of his wife, his dogs, the Goebbels family, and General Krebs. A number of photographs accompanied the official autopsy reports, and among the pictures of views of what are purported to be Hitler's bridge work and teeth removed from the body, as well as Eva Braun's dental bridge and a photograph of Hitler's favorite German shepherd bitch, Blondie. We shall return to these photographs and the views of the author directly, but first, a brief discussion of dental forensics is in order. So bear in mind here that forensic dentals, is the basis for the alleged identification of Adolf Hitler by Lev Bezymensky. And note here, too, that he was with the KGB. As we shall see, Both the official Soviet version about what happened to Hitler and the Western version were produced by people who were working for the intelligence services of their countries, and as we shall see, that is, I suspect, not accidental, not coincidental. The next section of Gregory Douglass's article is important to understand why the alleged identification of Hitler's remains from the dental records is extremely shaky, to say the least. The next part of the discussion talks about the criteria necessary in order to make a positive forensic dental identification, and as we shall see, these criteria were most assuredly not met in the situation of Adolf Hitler. Continuing with Gregory Douglass's account. In establishing the identity of human remains by dental forensics, a number of factors must be taken into account. Firstly, photographs and x-rays of the teeth and dentation of the deceased must be prepared. Secondly, these photographs and x-rays must be compared with the actual dental records of the deceased to include, if possible, x-rays of the deceased's actual teeth and any dental fillings. One more time, these last two sentences. Firstly, photographs and x-rays of the teeth and dentation of the deceased must be prepared. Secondly, these photographs and x-rays must be compared to the actual dental records of the deceased to include, if possible, x-rays of the deceased's actual teeth and any dental fittings. If these two sets of data are identical, the identity of the deceased should be established to a strong certainty. It should also be stated that a specific chain of control must exist for this evidence to be valid. An actual corpse must exist and be in a controlled environment such as a morgue or mortuary. The photography and x-rays must be prepared of the body under controlled conditions and the resulting negatives and prints kept in a secure area. Also, the dental records must be original and must also be secured as evidence. Note that. The reasons for this should be as evident to the layman as they are to the professionals of law enforcement agencies and insurance companies. Without proper control exercised over the two sets of records, the opportunity for manipulation is obvious. And as we shall see, there was anything but the proper control exercised over the two set of records. Far from it. The next section of Gregory Douglass's article is an important one. This deals with Dr. Hugo Hannes Blaschke, Blaschke. He was Hitler's personal dentist, also the personal dentist of many of the other leaders of the Third Reich. And as we shall see, his records disappeared in late April of 1945. They have never been found. Gregory Douglass writes of this: on the evening of April 20th, 1945, following the parade of dignitaries who paid their respects to Adolf Hitler on the event of his 56th birthday, Hugo Hannes Blaschke, a general of the Waffen-SS, senior dental officer of that organization, a member of Himmler's personal staff, and Hitler's longtime dentist, paid a brief and hurried visit to his Reich Chancellery dental office. Here he quickly assembled and packed into cases his dental equipment and all of the dental records of his prominent patients, including Albert Speer, Heinrich Himmler, Hermann Goering, Joachim von Ribbentrop, Josef and Magda Goebbels, Martin Bormann, Eva Braun, and Adolf Hitler. These files were flown out of Berlin later that night, along with SS General Dr. Blaschke and a number of other senior officials. The flight landed near Salzburg early the next morning. Blaschke's entire file case vanished at that time, and none of its contents have ever surfaced. Now again, his patients Speer, Himmler, Goering, Ribbentrop, Goebbels, Martin Bormann, as well as Hitler and Eva Braun. What happens to Dr. Blaschke's records? Again, the flight landed near Salzburg early the next morning. Blaschke's entire file case vanished at that time, and none of its contents have ever surfaced. Obviously, right there, it calls into serious question any attempt to identify Hitler's body from dental records, because Hitler's dental records disappeared, as did those of many of the other top leaders of the Third Reich. In the past, as I've dealt in one way or another during the research with the death of Adolf Hitler, I have not paid a great deal of attention to it. I have never taken the official version at face value, largely because of this fact. I have never seen anything about these records, the dental records having turned up, and with the records themselves having basically become casualties of the war for one reason or another, I have simply never viewed documentation based on dental comparisons as having any credibility. That is also apparently the view held here by Gregory Douglas. But note that one of the two sets of records that are deemed necessary for a positive forensic dental identification obviously was not met. Hitler's records, his dental records, vanished. And as we shall see, the records that have survived, the quote records unquote that have survived, are drawings made from memory by Dr. Blaschke, a general in the Waffen-SS, and obviously, as pointed out here very accurately by Gregory Douglas, hardly a party who would be viewed as disinterested. Continuing now with Gregory Douglas's discussion of Dr. Blaschke. The Führer dentist was subsequently taken into American custody, where he claimed he would make an attempt to, quote, to reconstruct Hitler's dentation from memory, unquote. The Soviet investigators probing Hitler's disappearance tried to locate Blaschke in Berlin so that they might interrogate him under their control. When they were advised that the dentist was in American hands and available for questioning, they promptly discontinued their search and never made any attempts at further contact. Note this, that when the Soviets learned that Blaschke had fallen into the Americans' hands, they, according to Douglas, dropped any attempts at further contact with Dr. Blaschke. Continuing. Without dental records, identification of missing Third Reich leaders was severely hampered, and a great deal depended on Dr. Blaschke's cooperation with his American captors. A brief study of Blaschke's background should be sufficient to dispel any question of where his true interests and loyalties lay. Hugo Hannes Blaschke was born on November 14, 1881, in West Prussia. He attended school in Berlin and volunteered for military service in 1900, serving as an NCO in the Reserve and later the Landwehr. In 1907, he moved to the United States, where he studied dentistry at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. In 1911, he established dental practice in Berlin. During the First World War, he served as a military dentist from August of 1914 to January of 1916, at which time he returned to private practice. Blaschke joined the NSDAP on February 1, 1931. By the way, NSDAP is the German Nazi Party. Blaschke joined the NSDAP on February 1, 1931, with the relatively low party number of 452,082. In March of that year, he joined the SA and rose to the rank of Sturmbannführer in 1932. In 1935, he was accepted into the ranks of the SS as Sturmbannführer and held the SS membership of 256,882. In 1934, Blaschke, who maintained private practice in Berlin, first treated Adolf Hitler for an abscessed tooth. He had been recommended to the Führer by Hermann Göring, another patient. Hitler had very bad teeth, resulting from years of poverty and neglect, and Blaschke did extensive work on the reconstruction of old bridge work. On May 2, 1935, Dr. Blaschke was promoted to Sturmbannführer and reassigned to the medical staff of the Reichsfuhrer SS, where he served as leader of the General Dental Hygiene Service. On April 1, 1936, he moved into the SS main office, advancing to Obersturmbannführer in 1937, and on April 20, 1939, the 50th birthday of his chief patron, was promoted to Standartenführer. On January 1, 1941, Dr. Blaschke joined the Waffen-SS, and in April of that year was promoted to Oberführer and appointed as a leader on Himmler's personal staff. He was subsequently promoted to Brigadeführer of the Waffen-SS on November 9th, 1944. By the way, Brigadeführer is the equivalent of a brigadier general. Continuing. His SS duties appear to have been purely nominal, as he spent most of his time at the Führerhauptquartier, having permanent quarters at the Wolfschanze at Rostenburg in East Prussia. He was certainly in Hitler's good graces, as he dined privately with him and his closest associates on a number of recorded occasions. This next paragraph is a vital one. Blaschke, therefore, was not a politically neutral civilian professional who was occasionally consulted by Hitler, but a party member with active membership in the SA and the SS. He was Hitler's dentist for 11 years, a member of Himmler's staff, a permanent guest at Hitler's headquarters for 4 years, and of close enough connection to dine with Hitler, Bormann, and other top Third Reich personalities, many of whom were his patients. U.S. Counterintelligence Corps interrogation files on Blaschke indicate that he appeared to be cooperative in his attempts to reconstruct Hitler's dental records, but that the results were of little value because the Führer dentist, quote, could do very little without his records, which have disappeared and cannot be located even after an extensive search, unquote. Blaschke eventually was released from custody and died in 1957 at the age of 77 without having contributed anything at all to verifying the deaths of a number of his patients. His records and x-rays are still missing. The next section of Gregory Douglass's article deals with a number of x-rays of Hitler's head, which have been passed down through the historical records. There are questions about those, too, and their bona fides, as we shall see. There exist a number of x-rays which purport to have been taken of Hitler's head. All of these were said to have been taken in 1944 and early 1945 by various doctors treating Hitler for various infections of his sinuses and tonsils following the failed Stauffenberg assassination attempt on July 20, 1944. The published records of Dr. Theo Morell, M-O-R-E-L-L, Hitler's chief doctor, indicate that the x-rays were taken at the Karlshof Military Hospital in Rostenburg, the location of Hitler's headquarters. These films were made at the request of Dr. von Eichen, a specialist called in to treat an infected sinus. Two x-rays were taken of Hitler's head on October 21, 1944, but proved to be, quote, too meager, unquote, for diagnosis. Several other x-rays were taken also at Karlshof on November 18, 1944, shortly before Hitler left the Wolfschanze for the last time. By the way, that's capital Wolfschanze. Other x-rays were produced by Dr. Giesing and were said to have been taken in Berlin in early 1945. Giesing, by the way, is G-I-E-S-I-N-G. The U.S. National Archives has copies of these x-rays, none of which have the standard German military medical information on the developed films. At least one x-ray has the date, quote, 21st October 44, unquote, scratched into it, whereas the proper German date would be 21 OKT period 44, unquote. The spelling of October is standard U.S. military form. There are no further identifying marks on these films. So again, what he's talking about here, what Gregory Douglass is talking about here, are some partial x-rays of Hitler's head taken by doctors, not dentists, but doctors who were treating him for various sinus and tonsil conditions. And these purported x-rays of Hitler's head also have some questions about them. Note the apparent discrepancy in the notation on the x-rays. One wonders whether these are actually x-rays of Hitler's head or whether perhaps they were concocted later, because there was, evidently, a subsequent cover-up of what truly happened to Adolf Hitler at the end of World War II, and for political reasons, primarily political reasons bearing directly on the Cold War, that information was kept secret. Continuing. The Bezymensky book, which appeared in 1968, makes no mention of these x-rays. Those are the x-rays in the American archives, but does show photographs of what the author purports to be the original bridge work found in what is claimed to be the badly charred and partially obliterated corpses of Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun. The author also includes a photograph of a small card showing a sketch of Hitler's teeth, purported to have been prepared on May 11, 1945, by one Käthe Heusermann, H-E-U-S-E-R-M-A-N-N, Dr. Blaschke's technical assistant, who assisted in the manufacture of bridge work for the dentist. To consider the Bezymensky publication as anything but crude disinformation would be a serious error for an objective historian to believe. Like Trevor Roper's 1945 report, which took him 2 weeks to prepare, the Bezymensky dissertation was obviously prepared to fulfill an official point of view. It should be noted that in the 1960s, Soviet writers were not free to express their views on international political matters, and in any case, like Trevor Roper, who was a member of MI6, Bezymensky was a KGB official. Trevor Roper, to be sure, is a far better writer, but in the end, the two books were prepared with similar goals. The Bezymensky work is fairly easily demolished because of extraordinarily poor research. The author states that on May 9, 1945, a Soviet investigator interrogated Heusermann. A transcript of the official report disclosed that Heusermann found Hitler's dental file in Blaschke's Berlin office. She then accompanied the investigators to the ruins of the Chancellery, where they discovered all of Hitler's dental x-rays and some gold crowns alleged to be destined for Hitler's mouth. The author, and this is obviously a major flaw with a capital M and a capital F in the Bezymensky research, the author appears to be unaware that all of these records were removed from the Chancellery on the night of April 20th, and that Hitler's dental records were kept in the Chancellery dental facility, not at Blaschke's private practice. I think that passage speaks for itself. It calls into very serious question with a capital S and a capital Q, the accuracy or the integrity of Bezymensky's research. I think Douglas has a good point here, which is that Bezymensky was working with KGB just as Trevor Roper was working with MI6, and that there were overriding political reasons why the truth concerning Hitler's true fate could not be discussed. On the Soviet, from the Soviet standpoint, the propaganda value of not having had Hitler escape from their grasp was certainly one motivation. It may also be that given the tangled webs that were being woven for the Cold War already at this point, they did not want to reveal just how much they actually knew about what had befallen Adolf Hitler, because obviously, as we shall see, some of the people deeply involved in helping Hitler escape were already working for U.S. intelligence in the post-war period. Continuing, more of Douglas's analysis of Bezymensky's work. As has been previously noted, Soviet agents seeking Blaschke in Berlin at once abandoned the search upon learning of his detention by the U.S. and made no attempt to contact him, although invited to do so by American authorities. The sketch of Hitler's dental work is accompanied by numerous notes, all in Russian, a language that Heusermann was not acquainted with at that time. A further lack of familiarity with his subject emerges rather painfully when Bezymensky discusses the purported corpse of Hitler's dog, quote, Blondie. This dog was a light brown German shepherd bitch that had been given to the Führer by Martin Bormann following the Stalingrad disaster. In 1945, she would have been a little over 3 years old. The dog, of whom Hitler was extremely fond, accompanied him everywhere, even on many of his trips. In 1945, she had recently whelped and was still nursing her pups at the end of April. The official Soviet autopsy report indicates that the dog in question had a black coat and white lower extremities, worn teeth, which would indicate a dog of about 8 years of age, and who had not been nursing at the time of death. Since an official Spanish police report of April 1945 mentions a, quote, large brown wolfhound, unquote, as part of the manifest of Hitler's personal transport, it could be assumed that, like her master, quote, Blondie, unquote, did not meet her end in Berlin. Bear in mind that transport and the record of the Spanish police, that is the Ju-290A6 that was Hitler's personal transport and which landed in Barcelona, Spain on April 27th. We're going to learn more about that later in the program. The next line of discussion here concerns a California doctor, Dr. Reidar Sognaes, S-O-G-N-A-E-S, who also made an alleged identification of Adolf Hitler based on dental records, obviously the problem being under the circumstances that the dental records disappeared. And obviously, in Bezymensky's account, there is a fundamental lack of awareness of the reality of the Third Reich leadership's dental records as of late April of 1945. There are clearly some fabrications in the Bezymensky account, and that casts the fabrications and the circumstances of the discovery of his alleged evidence raise serious questions about the veracity of Bezymensky's account. Continuing with Gregory Douglas's analysis, in 1972, Dr. Reidar Sognaes, a professor of anatomy and dental biology at the University of California, delivered a paper at a seminar on forensic science held in Scotland. Dr. Sognaes strongly believed that he was now able to prove that a positive identification of Hitler's remains had been made as a result of his own brilliant detective work among the archives. His conclusions stemmed from a comparison of some purported Hitler head x-rays, which he claimed had somehow been mislaid in the National Archives, only to be discovered by himself in a brilliant coup in 1972 with the Bezymensky pictures and drawings. He also claimed that he had searched Blaschke's interrogation file and had found the dentist's sketches from his memories of Hitler's dental work. This file was also located at the National Archives. Since all of the data appeared to coincide, Sognaes concluded that the corpse stated to have been found in the Chancellery Garden was that of Adolf Hitler. Parenthetically, Sognaes and other dental forensic specialists concluded that the alleged body of Eva Braun was, to a certainty, not the remains of Hitler's wife. It has been further published that the artificial teeth contained in what the Russians have stated was Eva Braun's bridge work found in the mouth of the very badly charged corpse would under no circumstances have withstood the heat of the cremation and would have been thoroughly melted. This subject no longer holds any interest for writers on the subject of Hitler's death. If one takes the previously stated criteria concerning positive identification of a body through dental forensics, it becomes immediately evident that the evidentiary chain does not and never did exist. Again, this is the thesis statement of this particular article. If one takes the previously stated criteria concerning positive identification of a body through dental forensics, it becomes immediately evident that the evidentiary chain does not, and never did, exist. The requirement of an actual body kept in a secure location has certainly not been met. The Russians have repeatedly stated that they burned the purported corpse of Hitler and scattered the ashes. The official Soviet statement that they had recovered Hitler's personal x-rays and dental records conflicts with extensive evidence that these records were removed from the Chancellery before the occupation of Berlin. In any case, the Soviets never produced any such material in the furtherance of their claims. Skipping down, the only x-rays available, namely those purporting to be of Hitler's head with his dentation visible, were in circulation long before the appearance of Bezymensky's book, and one x-ray had been sold at public auction. If the Soviets had wished to prepare fake bridgework to support a claim of discovering Hitler's body, they not only had Blaschke's own technician in lengthy custody, but over 20 years in which to do so. In summation, all Dr. Sognes had to do was to compare x-rays, a written post-war approximation of Hitler's bridgework, all of which information was available prior to the publication of the Russian book, with photographs and a sketch appearing in that work to arrive at an obvious conclusion. Not one scrap of this material could ever be presented in a responsible court of law to support a claim of identification. There is a regrettable tendency for many authors in treating an historical subject to write an idea. In doing so, they will accept any theory or any document, no matter how illogical, which will tend to prove their case, and reject any material which would tend to disprove it. They will, in sum, strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. Many of the same facts concerning the dental forensics of Hitler also apply to Martin Bormann. In the next issue, we shall see how the purported discovery of Bormann's remains is as tainted as that of his chief. Also, the extensive utilization by U.S. and British intelligence of very senior SS functionaries such as Heinrich Müller, Odilo Globocnik, Otto Skorzeny, and Christian Wirth, W-I-R-T-H, as well as such diverse personalities as General Burgdorf and the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem will be covered in detail. Such factors as faked suicides, false papers, and the disclosure of a treasure of over 300 million in gold and jewels that still remain hidden in the Austrian province of Carinthia will be explored for the first time. So again, the basic points of that article are that the official Soviet history, as well as a corroborating document here in the United States, were based on comparisons of questionable head x-rays of Hitler showing part of his dentation on sketches that were made by Dr. Hugo Blaschke from memory, which he admitted were inadequate to the purposes at hand. Note that Dr. Blaschke was a loyal member of the SS, and therefore, as the article notes, hardly a disinterested party. And note again that the official dental records of not only Hitler, but most of the other top Nazi leadership vanished in late April of 1945. They have never been discovered, and that from the standpoint of forensic science, that would render a dental identification of Adolf Hitler's remains extremely questionable from a legal standpoint, or not questionable from a legal standpoint, inadequate from a legal standpoint, or highly questionable from an historical standpoint. Again, one can speculate about why the Soviets would disseminate disinformation about Adolf Hitler's death, in part at least, possibly for propaganda purposes, because they would not have wanted to appear ham-fisted. They had Berlin encircled, and they would not perhaps have wanted to admit to having let Hitler slip through their hands. Propaganda was a major factor in Soviet media coordination during the Cold War. Also, since, as we shall see, the people that were handling Hitler's escape were people inextricably linked with the incorporation of large elements of Third Reich intelligence into Western intelligence in the Cold War period, it may be, too, that the Soviets did not want to reveal just how much they actually knew about what had happened to Hitler, for as we shall see, some of the British intelligence operatives that were involved with some activities on the continent of Europe in the post-World War, in the immediate post-World War II period, well, those British operatives were involved in a rather tangled web of penetration by the Soviets at the time. What we're going to look at after another short musical break is the critical analysis by Gregory Douglas of what has come to be the accepted work on the death of Adolf Hitler, on the quote death of Adolf Hitler, Sir Hugh Trevor Roper's The Last Days of Hitler. We're going to take a musical break now, and then when we come back, we're going to hear about just how fallacious this particular work is as well.